time now for the Weekly Word with Professor Stephen Hines. Today we're joined with Jim Allen Willis with the Marcellus Drilling News.
Professor Stephen Hines, energy columnist, and the Word Merchant.
And this is Jim Willis, editor and founder of Marcellus Drilling News, coming to you from the unusually sunny upstate New York area.
All right, good deal. So we're going to talk a little bit about pipelines, a little bit about fracking today. So let's start off with pipelines. So let's go to the East Coast. And Jim Willis, start off a little bit by what's going on in the world of pipelines in the East Coast.
Well, it seems today, Jason, that you know, most of the stories are about pipelines. In fact, I chronicle what's going on in the Marcellus and the Utica on a daily basis, and I've had a number of subscribers for a number of years, and I get complaints like, "Gee, you know, can you talk about some more drilling for a change instead of pipelines?" But you know, pipelines are a big deal, obviously. So we have the Marcellus and the Utica, and if you combine those two together, you know, really just a powerhouse as far as natural gas goes. And in the Utica, you know, even a decent amount of oil coming out of there. So you have to get all of that gas from where it's produced to markets, you know, where there's demand. And so for a number of years, we've had, you know, any number of different pipeline projects, that have been coming along. Some of them are done or near done. Others aren't even off the boards yet. But pipelines are really where it's at right now.
Let me just jump in here for just a second before we transition over to Professor Hines. Professor Hines, as we've talked in the past, some of the pipeline projects, you know, they get some controversy at times. Obviously, the Keystone Pipeline Project, the spill happened right before it went online. It's online now. It's approved now. Talk a little bit about the Midwest and then transition into some of the politics, some of the issues, if you will, and then we'll switch it over to Jim to talk a little bit about the East Coast issues and see if they compare with the Midwest. Go ahead, Professor Hines.
Well, it's interesting that the last leg of the Keystone, and it was the single thing that held up the project for us in who knows how many years, actually, from the drawing board. That got approved in Nebraska. Of course, the commissioners didn't send a very clear-cut sign because we still don't know what will be the final pipeline and where it will go in Nebraska. So, that it lends itself to some confusion, and I think it's safe to say that your Dakota Access is confusing in its own right, Jason. Hmm. On the one hand, you've approved it. You're sending, I don't know how many barrels, you can probably add on in a second to be more precise. There is still a court action in North Dakota that says they're going to review the decision sometime in March or April of next year. So in some ways, it would be nice if we actually did something all the way instead of 51% or something like that. And I think the same thing is going on here in Wisconsin, Upper Michigan, Minnesota. It really has, as Jim said, come down to a battle of pipelines. You guys, you produce enough on your own, frankly, up in the upper Midwest to provide an awful lot of our energy needs. But it's one thing to have it, another thing to get it someplace else, as Jim was saying.
Jim, I'll bring you back into the conversation here. How have the incidents that have happened over the last month, 2 months, whatever it might be, from the Dakota Access Pipeline to the Keystone Pipeline, has that affected you guys in the Ohio, New York, Pennsylvania area?
Well, it's a good question. Is there a direct connection? On one hand, I would say no, but on another hand, I would say yes. I covered a story a while ago, maybe upwards of a year ago, when all of the stuff was going on with the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I was kind of following that because that will come up in my daily trawl of the news. And I noticed that some of the people that are located here, that are based here in Pennsylvania and Lancaster County, for instance, there's a group called Lancaster Against Pipelines. And the people that founded that group went out and participated in the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. You know, those wonderful protests you had out there. So I read also, and I covered this in a story, that essentially they were, this is back in the Obama administration, they were saying, you know, gee, we've stopped the Dakota Access Pipeline, at least they had at that point, and we're coming for you next, you know, in the Marcellus and in the Utica. It's a birds of a feather kind of a thing, Jason. A lot of the people that tend to protest this locally, when I go to meetings and so forth, there's a lot of out-of-towners, you know, so it's like they travel around to these various protests. And in some cases, they're actually paid. You know, there are organizers that come into our area that have been to your area. So I'm not blaming you. I'm not saying they come from there. They come from California, you know, and other places. So I do see a connection. I absolutely see a connection. But I think it's because there's a bit of an organized movement that's going on here. And that organized movement, I think, Jason, I've listened to some of your broadcasts, and I think you and I and Steve all, you know, have very similar thoughts on this. And that is, you know, these people are essentially at their core, they're anti-fossil fuel. And I find that to be an irrational position intellectually to hold. But we have to understand that that's really what is motivating a lot of these people and a lot of their objections to pipelines. It used to be pipelines were non-controversial, you know. I mean, you never heard about anyone objecting a pipeline going in anywhere. I didn't care where it was. And it's only been in the last few years, really, that, you know, they kind of put two and two together. Well, if we can stop the pipelines, then we can stop, you know, what's happening. If we can stop the midstream, we can stop what's happening in the upstream.
Let me jump in here for just a moment. And the reason I'd like to jump in is this is a very interesting topic. This is a very good place to sidebar. And the reason I believe that is several, and Steve, you might know this back in your protesting flower child days, was there was a lot of protesting done in the 60s, 70s. And then people started having credit. People started having student loans. People started having mortgages. And your job was somewhat related to the daily part of your life. And so protesting went down because people had to work. And if your boss saw you protesting, maybe you got fired. There was a lot of reasons why protesting went on the decline. So what's happened now is protesters, it's a paid position. That's how you pay your mortgage. And I see these people as very passionate about their job. And so even if it's true or not, they're going to exaggerate, much like a lot of people in the media do, trying to defend or trying to elaborate type of a thing. Do either one of you follow my train of thought on the whole evolution of a protester?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll jump in. Steve, I don't know if you have something you want to add, but...
of course I do, you remember.
It was about, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6, maybe 7 years ago now, I attended a meeting locally. I'm from the upstate New York area, and this was back when we thought, you know, hydraulic fracturing would come around in New York State and would help out, you know, local farmers and landowners in this neck of the woods. And so it was a pretty hot topic, and there were various meetings that would take place, you know, some for, some against. And I attended one that was against to cover it editorially. So I had to take one for the team. And as I was sitting there, I made this observation. There were, it seemed to me like there were a lot of kids, right? There were young people, like college students, but there were also a lot of older people, like gray hair, guys with no hair on the top but long ponytails. And I made this sort of tongue-in-cheek observation in one of my articles that, you know, this protest movement against these pipelines and against fracking has become, it's a renaissance movement for old hippies. It's like, hey, you know, they've injected new meaning in their lives. And so what you have, Jason, your observation is spot on. You have a bunch of kids, the new hippies, if you will, and you have a bunch of old hippies, you know, in their 50s and 60s, that tend to gravitate to these things, I think. What do you think, Steve?
Well, you know, I just wanted to go back and talk about a couple of things. I noticed, and I want to say it was about 4 years ago, that the NRDC put an ad for interns, 400 or 500 interns. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was the Sierra Club, because they had promised Michael Bloomberg that they wouldn't take a stand against natural gas when he donated money. Of course, that didn't take long for them to violate that. But the Sierra Club put an ad, and they hired, I don't know, 400 or 500 interns, and they were paying them $450 a week. And their sole job was to make cold calls to people to talk about pipelines and net fracking. That was it. Their job was to harvest fellow protesters. And so what does that say to me? It said, wow, they got money. They're getting organized. And we will ignore them at our own risk. So that's one thing. The other thing was a conference they had in secrecy, I suppose, I think in Stanford in 2012. And a bunch of academics and outward speakers, I think, for example, Michael Mann was there, and Naomi, can you pronounce her last name for me, Jim, once? Aranquez, she's a professor at Harvard. Anyway, they devised a new strategy to take on fossil fuels. If you ever have a chance, they settled on the notion that they were going to compare fracking and fossil fuels to tobacco. Yep. But they really worked out this very intellectual game plan back there. And it was all done, in a sense, you know, behind the scenes. There's no real direct connection to these academics and this discussion, unless you do a search. But if you do, it's very enlightening, because what you're seeing as far as protests on the ground, you know, what I call a good ground game. I love your image of aging flower children. Of course, I'm one, by the way. But I don't. I'm in favor of natural gas. But it's, they've entered a very, you know, they've gone from minor leagues to major leagues. And they are doing a lot of legal work. I told the story to Jason about how, and I think it was the Sierra Club, was starting an action against one of the smaller pipelines out by you. And the only person they had that gave them standing in the case at one of the appeal courts got settled with the oil company. And now the Sierra Club couldn't even talk in front of the jurors. Why? Because they didn't have any standing. So they have another example, and then I'm going to shut up. Well, kind of. Is what's going on out in Washington and Oregon, where they are organizing high school students to make filings against anybody they can on climate change. And there is, of course, being funded and intellectually supplied by the large environmental groups. But, you know, so they're really starting to go farther and farther into the gene pool, you know, down into seniors in high school. And you probably know, both you guys know this, but one of the publications that really that was trying to be a sort of skeptic to the alarmism was removed from libraries. And even places like Australia have started, and Britain have started to say, we have to teach our children sooner about climate change. Everywhere, but they're certainly going down into and to make sure that there's the same thinking, so they don't have to worry about it. You know, here, one last thing. Jerry Brown, I don't know if you saw this when he was over in Brussels last week, I think. He's giving a pontificate, he's pontificating about their new cap and trade and blah, 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 what California's doing. And he said, you know, if we have to brainwash our Californians to do it right, we will. And I thought to myself, boy, I'm glad I've met Jerry Brown before, because that remark was remarkably dumb, and it could have only come from Jerry Brown.
Let me go ahead and just jump in here for just a second, move things along here. We could talk all day about this. So, okay, let me just jump in for 1 second here. Otherwise, we could go all day on this. But I did want to just kind of wind down, recap a little bit here. When you're talking about going younger and younger, I just had this conversation with somebody in the Bakken last week. And they were talking about the same thing, about how they started getting to the children in high school about things that are not decided yet on climate change, for example. That's what he was talking about, because he didn't realize the jury had made a decision at this point. And so our discussion got into education, which means you can get an education anywhere. Henry Ford has an 8th grade education. Steve Jobs dropped out of college. Bill Gates dropped out of college. You want to talk about some of the most successful people on the planet? They got an education in life. You get an education anywhere. School is a training ground. So when you start talking about how they're getting these kids younger and younger, they're going to the training ground known as school. Don't let the word education fool you. You can get an education anywhere. Now, let me tell you about my education. I read a little something by Karl Marx called Religion is the Opiate for the Masses. If that's the truth, then the religion of environmentalism is true, and debt is the opium for the protesters. Ha, ha, ha.
Absolutely true. Going farther, I'm 2 French courses short of a Happy Meal from Columbia. But I have to say my alma mater, between their graduate programs, which have really the environmental graduate program and others, I think they even have some of the labs to view the heavens in Columbia. But it's hard to be, hard to feel very much pride about Columbia or almost any of the other Ivy League schools. Why? Because they have politicized the issues in and around environmentalism, and a good part of their revenue for their professors, the grants for the school, the grants for the people, even their interns, is coming from places like the EPA, the federal government. So in some ways, if I looked down and I thought, wow, at least we have, the Ivy Leaguers are there, and they're gonna stand up for intellectual freedom and free speech, and it doesn't look like they are. And they've slowly, behind the scenes, taken so much money from the governments that they can't go back.
Looking at the clock here, we got about 8 minutes left here, and so I wanted to get into the East Coast and the Midwest differentials. The first one that comes to my mind is just the whole natural gas and the depths of just drilling and the fracking and everything like that. We're 2 miles below the surface here in the Bakken. Obviously, on the East Coast, it's a little bit different. And I just wanted to start with maybe something as simple as that to kind of describe the differences. And then, Professor Hines, you jump in when you feel Mr. Jim Willis has answered that satisfactory, and then ask your question, and then we'll just kind of wrap her up from there. But I'm looking at the clock, so I just had to be the host and try to take control of the clock here. So, Jim Willis, let's just talk about the difference between the Bakken and some of the East Coast plays, maybe like the Utica or the Marcellus.
Sure. Well, with the Marcellus, and so I'm going to talk in generalities, and I'm sure it's the same in the Bakken. It depends on where you're at in the play. I live just across the border from northeastern Pennsylvania, Susquehanna County, where companies like Cabot Oil and Gas drill, and Chesapeake and some others. And I would say, typically in the Marcellus, they're going down somewhere around a mile. It's, you know, it's maybe 5,000 feet, 6,000 feet, somewhere in that range that they go down before, you know, before they drill the lateral. The lateral. And so I would say, roughly speaking, through most of the Marcellus, you're looking at around a mile down. Now, there are other plays under the Marcellus and over the Marcellus. So the Utica actually is larger, geographically speaking, than the Marcellus and underlays most of the Marcellus. There are some places where the Utica does not go under it, but under most of the Marcellus, it's there. And it also peaks out of the edge of the Marcellus over into eastern Ohio. And the Utica layer is typically around 9 or 10,000 feet down. So roughly twice the distance down that the Marcellus is. And then if you come up, we have the what's called the Upper Devonian. I mean, it's all pretty much in the Devonian layer, the rock layer. We have something called the Upper Devonian, which is, it's been a while since I've looked at these numbers, but I know it's above the Marcellus. I'm guessing it's around 3,500 feet down, something like that. And there are some other smaller plays over here on the East Coast in various areas of Rogersville, which kind of straddles West Virginia and Kentucky. And then there's some really small ones, and there's even some plays in New Jersey and Philadelphia, you know, in those areas. But of course, they're absolutely allergic to anything to do with drilling. So I wouldn't look for any kind of activity in those plays anytime soon. But the two big ones, of course, are the Marcellus and the Utica, 5,000 feet down and 9 or 10,000 feet down, roughly.
Well, and I'd like to add on, Jim, that when we talk about the Midwest, you know, you have the have and the have-nots. Right in the middle of it, including Wisconsin, Minnesota, South Dakota, Iowa, Missouri, they don't have any, there's no fracking going on. Why? Because they have nothing to frack. So in some ways, there's almost this natural division between the Midwest haves and the Midwest have not. So in many ways, you know, the Iowas and South Dakotas almost say, well, what's that got to do with me? Now, Wisconsin does sand, or at least it has been doing an enormous amount of sand business, both to the Bakken, but also down to Texas. Although I think they found some good sand finally down in Texas. But anyway, so...
But Steve, there is a connection.
What's that?
There is a connection, though. Even in those places like in the Midwest that you're talking about, when you're talking about Iowa and some of those other states, they have a lot of farms. And farms, and this was new to me a few years ago, and I was researching and reading about it, but they're big users of, if I'm not mistaken, of propane. You know, they use it for drying crops and things like that. So, you know, even if they don't produce it, they still use it in large quantities. And so there's this whole ecosystem that's developed.
That's a good point. Certainly more than most, probably more than anybody up in North Dakota, Jason, given your pedigree and your length of service up there. But, in some ways it is really, as end users, but as you pointed out some time back, I mean, protesters come in with their SUVs and all of those modern conveniences, and don't seem to notice that they're living one way and they're asking everybody else to live another.
That's, I don't know, Jason has any comments on that. I mean, my observation has always been, look, you know, you come to, you go to a protest meeting, and the hue and the cry is not that, you know, although sometimes they'll bring it up, not that, you know, it's polluting the water, it's polluting the air, or this, it's that it's causing global warming, right, climate change. And my point is, okay, you came to this protest today wearing sneakers made from petrochemicals.
Exactly.
Clothes made from petrochemicals. You arrived here in a vehicle powered by fossil fuels. You woke up in your toasty warm apartment or house this morning that is heated with fossil fuels, and the shingles on the roof are made out of fossil fuels, and
reliable electricity, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, even the protest sign is made out of fossil fuels. You know, those big, long plastic protest signs that they carry around, is made out of petrochemicals. How ridiculous, how hypocritical is that?
I completely agree with you. In fact, I got to go a step further and say that a lot of these protesters, I call it the religion of environmentalism, because a lot of times when you start going into that realm of things, you're talking about a passion that is really difficult to change somebody's mind. In fact, I think Einstein said it's easier to split the atom than it is to change a man's mind. And so, I mean, when you start talking about things like that, and like the great philosopher George Carlin said, a lot of these environmentalists aren't really concerned about an environment in the abstract. They just want their close area taken care of so they don't get bothered or inconvenienced. And I've kind of always thought a lot that, like I said, the great philosopher George Carlin, he nailed it right. He's got a lot of stuff out of YouTube if you want to check it out. Okay, and then I want to make a quick joke to illustrate Jim's point about the drying, which is when we were flaring natural gas at record levels, I know the state was kind of cracking jokes about how I wish we could just pipe it into the grain bins because our farmers use so much, so much natural gas and petroleum to propane to dry the grain. And so your research and your comment was exactly right. Up here in the upper Midwest and in, upstate New York, where there's a lot of agriculture, well, upstate's, I think, more dairy, but you get the point, where that is something. That whether you're producing oil or natural gas or not, those farmers need it, just like diesel. They need diesel, whether they have it or not. Okay, I just wanted to, Jim Willis, Professor Stephen Hines, kind of do a closing summary, if you will, about what we're talking about here is exactly what Jim Willis said, the ecosystem that's created. We've got fracking sands companies in Wisconsin. Professor Hines is right. New Mexico, Texas, Arizona, they're finding sands that they can use down in the Permian and the Wolf Camp and some of the other shales down there, shale plays. You got Indiana Brothers, they're a fracking company, I think, out of Indiana. So my point is that this ecosystem that's created from Shale Play USA is a nationwide thing. It's not just North and South Dakota. It's not just Pennsylvania and New York. No, it's the ecosystem of the country. And so if you take a look at the only job creator in the last decade, it's oil and gas. Every other industry over the last 10 years has shrunk. Oil and gas has increased jobs. When you look at the population of the United States, that has grown in the last 10 years. That's the closing comments I'd like to hear from you guys about this ecosystem and how everything has gone together to actually create jobs for people in the country.
Sure. So, as far as an ecosystem goes, I think, probably the best example I can think of in my neighborhood around here, two examples. One is Shell has committed to and is right now constructing an ethane cracker petrochemical facility about 20 miles outside of Pittsburgh. And that facility is being built because of the prolific amounts of ethane that we're producing. Of course, when you sink a hole in the ground and you're looking for natural gas, other hydrocarbons come out with it. Sometimes oil comes out, sometimes, natural gas liquids. And one of those natural gas liquids is ethane. Ethane, pentane, butane, propane, isobutane, all sorts of things come out of the ground. But the most common NGL is ethane, and we have a lot of it. And right now, it's a waste product. We're burning it. We're mixing it in with the natural gas stream in order to get rid of it. So Shell is investing $6 billion with a B to build this plant, And that won't be the end of it, because what they'll produce out of it, of course, is polyethylene, and essentially plastic, right, raw plastic. And then other manufacturing companies are now citing, they're now starting to commit to building facilities or expanding facilities in the region, because we are very close to, I forget what the number is, like 60% of the population in the U.S. is within a, you know, 10-hour drive. So Shell, you know, is building this, and there's going to be all, and just like, you know, satellites, you know, around it, all these manufacturing facilities are going to be setting up. The other thing I'll mention very quickly in passing is China just signed memorandums of agreement to invest $84 billion with a B, and this is incomprehensible, in West Virginia in order to invest in shale and in petrochemicals in West Virginia. And that is just massive. That is going to be a real game changer. So you talk about how it's all connected together. I mean, it is. It absolutely, it's all connected together.
Well, and so many great points between you two guys. I'm happy to be a part of this conversation. But, you know, I think that the story's become so complex that the scientists are really kind of out of it, because they don't understand how many other things, including job formation and economics and geology, you know. So, and the story has kind of been turned on its head now that we're shipping liquid natural gas to places of the world that are replacing cow dung, wood chips, charcoal, really dirty coal. And why isn't anybody noticing that that may be the most important play to the rest of the world, reducing emissions, and it's going to be done by the private sector for the right reasons?
But yeah, anyway, I absolutely agree.
This, the debate has really bypassed, you know, the groups of people who are specialized, even climate scientists. Why? Because now we have to talk about broadband, the FCC, we have to talk about the Department of Interior, we have to talk about the Department of Energy, we have to talk about the EPA, we have to talk about the FERC. And one thing Jason and I talked about was, it looks like the FERC, that with their majority now, is going to stop walking around in ballet slippers and start doing things that they should do. And out west, the federal government is going to stop holding up potential leases that will provide revenue to the federal government by 3 and 4 years, when it, by statute, is supposed to be done within 90 days. And, oh, by the way, the environmentalists don't have any example of really bad behavior by a company that leased federal land and then and rehabbed it after they were through, as you pointed out, Jason. And that's all I have to say. Well, that's not true.
And once again, that was Professor Stephen Hines with the Weekly Word this week. We were joined by James Allen Willis with the Marcellus Drilling News. For more information on either one of those individuals, visit our website at thecrudelife.com. That's thecrudelife.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter. Never miss an interview. Never miss an interview like this or many of the other ones we have on our programs with our weekly newsletter. Once again, that's available at thecrudelife.com. My name is Jason Spies, and this is the Crude Life Media Network, and that was The Weekly Word with Professor Stephen Hines.